I'm Brandy. I host Texas Wine and True Crime.
I'm Chris. I'm her sidekick.
Not
so
true.
So I guess they'll call me a host as well. I get a little billing on the billboard out in front there.
Well, we're happy to be back here. October is our favorite month. We love doing live shows in October. Chris just had a big birthday in October. Our wedding anniversary is November 1st, the day after Halloween.
Day after Halloween, yes.
We did that on purpose. And then we put out our first episode.
I voted for Halloween, but I got outvoted.
So. No. We did our first show on Halloween 2 years ago. So this October 31st will be our two-year anniversary of our podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been awesome. So,
should we tell everyone how we kind of got this whole caper started?
Yeah, what we do, what we talk about?
Well, no, but I mean, how did this all begin? How did the podcast start?
Well, I lost my job because of COVID. Is that what you want me to get into sad stories? Okay.
There's nothing sad. It turned out, it's a good run.
I was bored. My kid became a remote learner, and I liked to talk and drink wine, and I decided I wanted to talk about true crime. So we started this little endeavor almost 2 years ago. In our living room.
I was not a huge fan of true crime, at least no. The type she liked. She liked all those stuff that the wife usually got over on the husband somehow. I like a little bit more of the criminal underworld in my true crime, however.
And this is an exciting day because you guys are going to be the first ones to hear Chris tell a story today from finish to end, right? Or beginning to end. You've never done that in one of our shows. This is
exciting.
Yeah, I'm
going to do it from finish to end, guys. It's going to be very short.
I've had no
very
breakfast.
Brief story.
Mimosa has been my breakfast, so we'll behave ourselves. All right. Well, here's what we do on our podcast. You can find us on Spotify, really anywhere you listen to your music. We'll be there. We tell a true crime story from Texas, typically. Sometimes we'll venture out of Texas. We have Texas wines here today. We have McPherson. There are so many wineries in Texas. There's over 400 wineries. Texas is sort of this hidden gem with wine. So if you ever need suggestions on wine or just want to order from a Texas winery and you know what kind you like, ask us. We're here to help with that.
We do speak the Texas wine gospel.
Yes, we do.
It's lots
delicious.
Of fine wineries. I think the biggest problem with a lot of the Texas wines is they're not a lot of stores. And so Even when you go to Total Wine, there's a very, very short, I wouldn't even call it an aisle. It's probably a quarter of the aisle. That's all Texas varieties. But they're always great to kind of go take little trips and visits, and they all ship to you. So it's, awesome. We've been very fortunate to try a lot of the blends. And
we have.
Yes.
And Chris, he loves to cook, so he pairs a dish with our wine on our show. So we get to eat and drink good wine and tell true crime stories.
And everything. We like Texas.
Yes, so. We do. And we're big victim advocates. If you have someone locally who is trying to get justice for a loved one, tell them to reach out to us. We always have families on our show. To tell their stories and really what they want people to hear. We understand that that's a way of healing and venting and really getting their loved one's story out. So we're not just here to talk about just true crime. We're here for families to have a platform to talk about what they need, right? Whether it's from law enforcement, whether it's from the community, whether it's for just change, because change is good. You can feel free to email us, text us, call us, whatever you guys want to do. All right,
they can
honey.
Text us? Is that possible?
If they ask for my phone number while they're here, they can.
Okay. Yeah, I think, too, this has been kind of a neat endeavor because it was a podcast. We thought, how do you leave your podcast? Is no longer a podcast when you go out into the real world. However, we do record these shows. And so if anybody says anything, it can't be used. Can't be easy against you in a court of law, I guess. No, actually, it's been kind of a fun deal. So
yeah. All right, babe. Are you ready to get in? I think they're ready to hear some stories. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay.
We're gonna do from the finish to the end, right?
Yeah, finish to the end. And I like when I like small groups like this because we can talk about cases that interest you towards the end, or if there's something that questions you have, let us know.
We've had a lot of good stories suggested to us by listeners as well, too, which has been cool as well.
Very cool. Yeah. We're going to talk about the Arlington Screaming Bridge. Anyone ever heard this story? Oh, only one person? Okay, all right. So this is about a group of six girls who were getting in the car after having, Chris, these are Arlington High School students getting in the car. Some have said it's after a football game. Some have said they were coming from a movie. You know, we were reading a bunch of like spooky Texas stuff, which is what we wanted to bring today. But here's what happened. This is a true story. So we have six girls in the car and they are heading home. There is a bridge at the corner of Bedford Street and Arlington Street. So apparently, Chris, you can't get in that vicinity anymore. There's barricades and all kinds of stuff. But
is this like a place people go visit?
This was a bridge that people crossed to get from one part of the street to the other. So yes. It was.
But I mean, after this whole story, I mean, it was like kids went there and hung out and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and also there have been multiple accidents at this intersection, or not at this intersection, but at this bridge. So the girls are traveling approximately 45 miles per hour in their car. We have six girls, 16-year-old Mary Lou Goldner, Claudia Jean Reeve, 17 years old. So they are driving, Chris, and funny enough, they start to hear honking behind them. So this guy comes forward and says, his name is Bill Young. After this accident, he tells the newspaper and police that he knew the bridge wasn't there, and what he was trying to do was honk it to make sure the girls stopped, or whoever was in that car stopped. He didn't know who it was at first. But what ends up happening is they think they floor it, because it scares them that somebody's behind them blinking.
Like he's coming to get them.
Like he's coming to get them and scares them. So they kind of hit the gas because they were going 45 to 50 and they thought that was a little fast coming over this intersection or over this bridge. Well, 2 years before this, the bridge was actually burned. It was an arson case. There were a few boys in Arlington High School who were rumored to have talked about wanting to burn the bridge. Or at least made, joking gestures that they were responsible. And this ended up being a big court case. Boys were arrested. But what happened was, honey, there were barricades that were set up all around this bridge. But for whatever reason, they were not there when the girls were driving in that direction. It is still a mystery who removed the barricades from this burned out bridge that nobody was supposed to be crossing. But they would have never gone across it if the barricades would have been there. So nobody knows who actually moved them.
Understood.
But they were moved. The bridge had been burned. Three girls end up dying in this crash. One of the girls comes out of surgery and decides and she can talk and explain what happened. And she tells them about the person behind them and that there was no barricades and they had no idea that it had, that it wasn't
no
there.
No lights or anything like that?
Nope. They had flashers and they had...
road hazard signs and stuff.
And then, but they were stolen. Everything kept getting stolen, barricades and stuff. So that's why they ended up putting this huge barricade. And then someone had moved it.
What does one do with a stolen barricade?
They're saying it was just teenagers, probably just moving stuff around. I mean, just causing problems. I mean, who knows? But they weren't there and they were supposed to be there. Now, this location was actually already called Death Crossing. And by the way, it is still there. I heard it's hard to kind of get to, but you can kind of see the vicinity of the area. But they never rebuilt the bridge.
And you mentioned the location. I know over there off 360, at least when I was growing up, they had you could kind of pull off the side of the highway and there was a lot of four-wheel drive trails and stuff like that you could go on. I wonder if this is very close. It kind of sounds like it's close to that.
Yeah, so the whole ghostly thing around this is that you can actually hear the screams of the girls when you... So people have said that when they drive up and stop and get out to, like, look around, they can actually hear some of the screaming of the girls. Because what happened is when they were coming to the bridge, going 45 miles an hour, there's no bridge. So they basically leap it, right, and hit the rock on the other side. And so the car flips twice and ends up upside down. And then a couple of those girls were killed on impact.
So this sounds like a field trip of sorts.
For who?
For us. We need to go here.
We have a lot of...
It's like a Marfa Lights in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
These are great field trip stories we're actually going to tell today because I had made... we're going to be talking about the Manger here in a little bit. But yeah, so this bridge, and so it's supposedly people have drove up. They have reported to police that they hear screams. One of the girls had a broken jaw and ended up breaking both of her arms. She was the one who actually told the story, but This is just a really, I don't know, like folk. You never know that with if these are true, but this one's actually true. These girls actually did die, and so. The Arlington Screams.
All right.
That's it.
Are we going to take our 8-year old?
Yeah, tell us the whole story.
All right. Well, very interesting.
All right. Are you guys ready to talk about the man that killed Halloween? Anybody heard of the Pixie Stick Killer?
Boo to the man who killed Halloween.
Oh, I love that. You guys have never heard of these. Okay. So let's talk about Ronald O'Brien because this guy is one piece of work. We're heading to Pasadena, Texas for this one. Chris, this is a famous case. This case is what made parents check their kids' candy when they thought there might be razor blades in it or when they thought it might be poisoned.
I don't know. We never checked our candy as kids. We just
I don't think we did either.
Yeah, like, unless it was like a crusty old apple or something like that. I think those usually got hurled back at the house, I think, if someone gave you the apple.
You were two when this happened.
Oh, yeah, totally remember it. Yeah.
So it was, like, you know, it was like younger. So, yeah, that's probably why. But anyways, this story is the story of Ronald O'Brien. Halloween night, 1974. He is going over to some friends' houses, and they are going to have dinner. He's with his wife, his 8-year-old son, Timothy, and their daughter, Elizabeth. Now, Ronald O'Brien was an interesting guy. He did not like Halloween, but this particular Halloween, Chris, he was more than excited to take his kids trick-or-treating. So his wife will come out and say that that was the first odd thing she noticed about that evening. But they end up making the 15-minute drive from Pasadena, Texas, from Deer Park, Texas, where they live, to Pasadena. It's about 15 minutes right out of Houston. I don't know if you guys have been to Pasadena. But they end up going to the Bates family home. So they have dinner. It's time to go trick-or-treating.
It's like the perfect Halloween house.
The Bates family home. So he takes their kids who are the same age. So they've got four kids with him, and the two fathers take them out trick-or-treating. Now, it ends up raining that night, so they don't go very far. They end up only going to about, I think they said maybe two streets over, because once this investigation was underway, it was really, the police honed on this pretty quickly. All right, so they're out trick-or-treating, and Ronald O'Brien takes his kids up to a house that has no lights on, doesn't look like anyone's home, but the kids knock anyway. No one comes to the door. So Mr. Bates takes the kids. Ronald O'Brien says, I'm going to keep trying. I'll catch up with the group. Now, it is never determined what happened in those few minutes that he went MIA at this house. But he ends up running back up to the group with five pixie sticks in his hands. And he says, look, kids, someone answered the door. They're handing out expensive candy, was basically what he tells Mr. Bates and the kids.
Yeah, everybody, that's a sign of wealth.
Yes, yeah.
Big pixie sticks.
1974. Yeah. This is the big long ones, right? So they still sell them today. Yes. All right. So they're finishing up their trick-or-treating. He's holding on to these pixie sticks. So they get back to the Bates house, and he gives two to his kids. He gives two to the Bates children. And then he gives one, the last remaining one, to a kid who comes and knocks on the door before they head back to their Deer Park home. So now he's handed out all the pixie sticks. He goes home and he tells his kids that they are allowed to pick one piece of candy before they go to bed. Remember that? I remember my parents saying that, like, have a piece and then go to sleep. And sometimes you have your bag of candy in the bed or right next to you. You know, these kids are little. They're like 6 and 8. So
you had the one piece of candy and then took the rest of the bag in bed with you.
Well, it's like, it's late at night, right? And they're like, you can have one. I don't know. Just, you go through your stuff.
That's where it all started going downhill for Brandy right there.
I don't hide candy in the bed.
Lying at the early age.
Lying, whatever. All right. So they get home and the father is encouraging Timothy to eat that pixie stick. Now, Timothy.
He picked for him.
He picked for him because the mother will eventually say that she heard her son telling the father that he wanted something else, but he was encouraging him to eat the pixie stick. Well, he couldn't get the thing opened, so his father opens the pixie stick for him. Timothy takes, you know, you cut the top of those and then you put in your mouth. It's like the powder. Mm-hmm. Well, he instantly tastes it, and he tells his dad, this tastes bitter. It's the first thing he said. The mother, by the way, the reason we know all this is because the mother ends up testifying to this stuff in court. So he eats the pixie stick 5 minutes later. And this is just, as parents, I mean, because this is real life, right? This really happened. And I mean, as parents, I think like you opened that for your child and gave it to them. And then 5 minutes later, this kid is screaming for his daddy because his stomach hurts. And he starts vomiting, convulsing, throwing up blood. They call 911. Ronald O'Brien, the first thing he says is, I think my kid ingested poisonous candy. So he's already kind of putting that into the ear of 911.
911, yes.
Right? We see this a lot in cases. If y'all really need to listen to 911 calls. I always say, like, people really give themselves away sometime when they forcibly give information that they're not necessarily asked. So that's what he says. He ingested poisonous candy, a pixie stick, and he needs help. So 911 comes, and unfortunately, Timothy did not even make it to the hospital. He died within just about, I think, under an hour after he ingested this candy. So when his body is brought to the morgue, the medical examiner, the thing he notices instantly is that he smells of almonds. By the way, that is a telltale sign of cyanide poisoning. We've talked about this. Chris is in the medical field. We've talked about just the smell of that. So this is why they test for that when they get that smell off of a body. Are you looking at me because you've never experienced cyanide in a patient?
I love how you, he's in the medical field. I'm the resident medical expert, pathologist, firearms expert, wear many hats in the Diamond household.
You do.
I'm really just a nurse, so that's about my only training.
You're so smart. All right, so they found, after the autopsy, they realized that he had ingested enough cyanide to kill 5 adult men, which is probably why he died so quickly.
Yeah, and I'm guessing back then, that was probably a very common ingredient in just your average over-the-counter rat poison.
It was easier to get. Yeah. There were stores that would sell it. He's actually seen, we'll get into this a little bit, but he was actually seen.
I mean, I don't think you went to your local Skillern's in 1974.
But there were places you could go and people you could
ask. That was a common ingredient in rat poison. That's what killed rats. It was very quick, very effective. And that's why that was rat poison was used a lot to kill people was because of the cyanide.
Yeah. Cops are worried about this pixie stick because they realize if Timothy had one, there's probably other kids who have them. So they but remember, Ronald O'Brien is the one that had them in possession. So he knew he had 5 in his hand. So he says, this guy or girl or whoever, I'm going to say guy because he says when the person handed him the pixie sticks, they just opened the door and stuck their arm out and all he saw was a hairy arm. I mean, I'm sure I don't have to tell you guys this, but if you open a door on Halloween and somebody hands you something and you can't see their face, don't eat it.
Especially if it's a hairy arm.
Yeah. And also the fact that police are like, probably thinking this is so weird. Like, who would this is strange, right? All right. So they know that there are 4 pixie sticks still unaccounted for. They go back to the Bates home, collect the 2 pixie sticks. And then Elizabeth did not eat hers, the daughter of Ronald O'Brien. It's not understood why he didn't try to get Elizabeth to eat it. I don't know if she was asleep with the mother already, because it will come into, we'll talk about this with the court. There were life insurance policies on both of those kids and an additional one that he took out before Halloween.
Yeah, that's the strange part of this story.
And the fact that you could get away with it so easily with insurance policies back then.
Yes.
Like, it's a little stricter now. All right, so they find the 2 pixie sticks at the Bates house, and then Elizabeth has the 3rd, but now there's 1 still unaccounted for. Remember the trick-or-treater that came to the door? So they end up finding that kid in the neighborhood. Y'all, he had the pixie stick in his bed, and it looked like he had tried to bite the top of it open. He couldn't get it open. So he just left it and went to sleep.
Those things were a real pain in the ass to get open.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. And this guy, so they end up finding, so they want to basically trace their steps. Where were you? What house were you at? Where did you get the pixie sticks? Pretty easy question. This should not take, much effort or time. So they actually, he tells them where they find it. So they go and find the owner of this home. This owner is a air traffic controller who was not home at the time. He was working at the airport. He had 200 witnesses verify that he was actually at his employment. So he tried to frame the person who lived there. But that was not, that wasn't easy to do, considering this guy was had a big job and a lot of people knew he was there.
Yeah.
So this guy is cleared of any wrongdoing. And so they focus then on the person who gave the pixie sticks, which is Ronald O'Brien. So they start going through Ronald O'Brien's background. And here's what they find out about this guy. He has had 21 jobs, Chris, in 10 years. 21 different companies had hired him in 10 years.
That's crazy.
Couldn't hold the job.
It's a lot of onboarding.
That's a lot of wasted resources, right?
Yeah.
No retainment for that guy. All right. And then they find out he's $100,000 in debt. And then they find out.
That's a lot of money in 1974.
That's a lot of money.
I mean, that's a crazy amount of money back then.
And then they find out that he, so he's an optician. And he is about to be fired from his job because he's accused of stealing from his company. So he's on the verge of that. They also find out that he has life insurance policies on both of his kids. Now, the first two policies on his daughter and his son, the mother did know about. Okay, but they were, I think they were $10,000 a piece. He ends up trying to take $20,000 a piece on them a few days before Halloween. So he forges his wife's signature on the policy, and his insurance agent was trying to tell him, listen, you really shouldn't do this. Back then, that was probably considered a lot of money on a child.
I would think $10,000. I mean, goodness.
Right. So an additional 20, so now 30,000 per kid, which wasn't even going to cover his debts. Chris, this is what they find in the house. They also find a pocket knife that had candy residue on it and plastic residue. So they do believe this is how he got them open. And he was actually able to poison the very top of the pixie stick, roll it back up, and he used actual staples, which makes sense of why the kids probably couldn't open it. It was, like, stapled up pretty well. They also find a note where he had wrote all of his debts, and he had wrote how much he owed on his debts, and then how much the kids' life insurance policies were, and then how much of his debt would be left. So they think they've got their guy.
Lots of evidence against this gentleman.
Yeah. So they decide to arrest him. So they arrest Ronald O'Brien. He says, of course, I would never kill my children. This is where I got the pixie sticks from. But police aren't buying it. And then they start digging a little deeper. And guess what else they find out? He has some friends come forward. He's asking a couple of people he knows how to get cyanide, where he can buy it, how much does it take to kill a human being, all these different questions that he's asking people. He's actually seen going into a somewhat of a chemical store where they carry cyanide. He ends up not buying anything, so they're not even sure why he decided not to buy it. They're not sure if it was too expensive or if he wanted to steal it. By the way,
it could have been the form it came into.
There is also, it has never been determined where he actually got the cyanide. They don't know. Nobody came forward and said that they gave it to him or anything, so they don't know where he got it. All right. So with all of this,
Well, that may be why it may in fact have come in a rat poison, because who pays attention to someone buying that over the counter in a grocery store?
Right.
I'm also the resident pest exterminator.
Yeah. You still need to remove that beehive in front of our house, by the way.
Beehive?
Or whatever
beehive.
It is. Wasp nest.
Wasp nest, yeah.
All right. Beehive, so now that they know all of this, they arrest this guy. They go to court. People testify. His wife said she had no idea about the additional policies. She never signed anything. They find out in the court proceedings, it's said that his car was about to be repossessed and that their home was about to be taken because he had defaulted on 6 different loans and he was not able to pay them. This guy brought in about $150 a week in his job is what the numbers came to.
What's that in today's dollars?
What, like 5,000? I don't know. 800? I have no idea. Do you?
No, I'm just asking you. Doesn't sound like much, right? Compared to the $10,000 life insurance policy.
Yeah. So he goes to court. People testify. Mr. Bates, his wife, the people he spoke to about where to get the cyanide. So this guy, and by the way, he is young. He's like 39 years old. I mean, he's 38 years old. This guy isn't very old. Actually, no, he's a lot younger than that. I think he was like 32 when this happened, and then he was 39 when he actually died. All right, so he goes to court. He is found guilty and sentenced to lethal injection. He dies. I want to read you his last words. By the way, he never admits to killing his son. He always says that he didn't do it. There was no reason for him to do something like that. All right, so here's what he says, quote, before they put the needle in his arm. What is about to transpire in a few moments is wrong. However, we as human beings do make mistakes and errors. This execution is one of those wrongs, yet doesn't mean our whole system of justice is wrong. Therefore, I would forgive all who have taken part in any way in my death. Also, to anyone I have offended in any way during my 39 years, I pray and ask your forgiveness, just as I forgive anyone who offended me in any way. And I pray and ask God's forgiveness for all of us respectively as human beings. To my loved ones, I extend my undying love. To those close to me, know in your hearts, I love you one and all. God bless you, and may God's best blessings be always yours. And then he says, P.S., during my time here, I have been treated well by all TDC personnel. Now, during his execution, there were 300 people outside, basically wanting to get in there and celebrate his execution. There were people that were said that were standing out there with pixie sticks, like, you know, like, oh, you know, this is, you know, weird. Like, it's just, can you imagine supporters? This? Just imagine. So almost zero supporters. Guards would say he had no friends in prison. Nobody really talked to him, and people wanted to kill him because he killed a child, and they don't fare well in prison.
Yeah, shocking. He had no friends.
No friends. Yeah. Nobody advocating for him. So this guy was put to death, and yeah, that is the story of the pixie stick killer.
So crazy.
I know. But this is the this is why people, like, you
but
know.
But, like, stapling the top. I mean, to me, that would just be the dead giveaway that's been tampered with, because every kid knows what a pain in the ass those things were to get into. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you have something that's just stapled on
but
top.
But he had to find a powder substance, you know.
No, I know. I'm just thinking, like, kind of lazily put the pixie stick back together. I mean, to me, like I said, know. But who knows. It but is 1974, so.
Well, and he was really hoping the other children would eat them, because if they did that, then it wouldn't have been on him, right? They would have been looking for someone who handed them out to kids. That's the reason he handed the poisonous candy to the others. But he was hoping they would eat it. And then it would be like, well, I didn't do that. Yeah, what benefit do I have to kill them?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Kind of setting the stage over the...
It's also a mystery where he hid the pixie sticks. So he didn't have them, right, when he started trick-or-treating. They're not sure if he broke and went to the car and then ran back to the group, or if he somehow had them, like, in his back pocket, maybe, with a shirt over it, and then he just whipped them out, or if he had them stuck in the back of his pants with a shirt of it. Nobody really knows how he or where he got them, but he had them hidden somewhere for him to retrieve. I mean, he had this whole thing set up.
Yeah, and you got to wonder how many copycats this kind of spawned.
There's a few. So if you Google this case, you'll see a few. I think there was one in Chicago. The Tylenol, remember the poisonous Tylenol? That happened very shortly after this.
On Halloween, they were giving out Tylenol?
No, it wasn't on Halloween.
Maybe that was the parents for the headaches of walking around their kids, dragging them candy around. Or like the guy on our street that had the shoot with the Coronas for the adults. That
oh, my gosh.
Genius.
So we have to tell you all this. During COVID, this guy built this machine to send out candy and beer out of his house onto the sidewalk, and you just waited there to retrieve it. And it was like this suction. It was amazing. It was like you pushed one for candy only, or you pushed two for candy and a beer. It was the best.
Can our kitchen get that installed?
I know. That was amazing.
I feel there had to be someone on the other end that's delivering this. You know, and I don't want to backtrack, but I meant to ask, because we didn't discuss on the first tale.
Yep.
Did these girls' parents ever, like, try to sue the city of Arlington for this not having the proper...
I don't know.
You know, I guess... what do you call it, safety barricades?
I do believe, yes, I do believe there was some sort of either settlement within the city. One of the girls that was injured, or I'm sorry, one of the girls that was killed, her father was actually a police officer in Arlington. Yeah. So the whole police department took the day off during her funeral. So there was a big investigation into it because they wanted to find out who removed the barriers. I mean, that was the big thing, is they had barricades around this.
Yeah, I would have to think they would have had some sort
they
of
put
a
reward
against,
out.
Against the city.
They put a reward out. If somebody would come forward asking or telling them where, you know, if they knew where the barricades were. But yeah, nothing was ever found. They ended up letting those boys go too. There was no trial because they just didn't have enough evidence. One of the boys said he had the matches and then he started to burn it. And it was like this whole racial thing. There was like a community right outside of Arlington, and they didn't want Hispanics and African Americans to come over on their side of Arlington. So, I mean, that was a thing too. These boys were heard talking about that. I don't know. Was it talk or was it real? They just never could come to a conclusion of that.
Well, how was the food, everyone?
How's the food?
Good.
Good. All right.
How was the wine? I'm the only one drinking wine. It's 7 o'clock somewhere.
Allison, right. Do you want to do a tasting, or how are you doing the wines today?
Okay.
Okay, cool. Honey, I'm going to pass, can I pass the mic over to you? Well, not really, but can I, do you want to do your story?
Sure. I'll do my story.
Okay. And then I'll do the Manger Hotel. Anybody stayed at the Manger Hotel in San Antonio? Oh man, we need a field trip.
Another field trip.
Wait till you hear about how many ghosts are said to be in this
hotel. The story of my
life,
field trips.
I do drag you everywhere. By the way, if you're going to be in West Texas, if you happen to be in West Texas.
If you happen to be 6.5 hours away from this current location in December.
December 3rd, Friona, Texas. There is a restaurant there that has asked us to come out and do a live show. There are 3,500 people in this town. They are doing a fine dining wine and dinner. It is, they farm their own stuff. They own their restaurant. It is such a cool concept, but random. One of the mother of the owner saw us at our live show in Lubbock at a winery, so that's why they asked us to come. All right, we are going to get started, and we are going to travel to San Antonio, Texas, and talk about what we think is the Manger Hotel.
According to how Brandy spelled it, it's Manger Hotel. But we
it's
believe not. It.
It's the Manger Hotel.
It's Manger. It looks like yes. A German of origin, M-E-N-G-R.
It is,
but
it
I was
is
giggling
a
because
German
she put
of origin.
M-A-N-G-R like little baby Jesus in the manger.
I was tired. Yeah. All right. So we are going to talk about the Manger Hotel. Now, the Manger Hotel, now I always thought the most haunted hotel in Texas was the Driscoll Hotel in Austin. Anybody ever stayed there? Yep, great hotel, very fancy. But they always say you can hear a girl bouncing her ball on the steps of the hotel there in Austin, the Driscoll.
It's very Shining-like.
It is very Shining-like. Yeah. Two women actually took their lives in the same exact room 25, 35 years apart at the Driscoll Hotel. Yeah. And you can always ask for that room.
But we're talking about the Manger Hotel
right now, not
the Driscoll Hotel.
No, but my
that was
the
last
reason,
time we were here.
Right, but the reason I brought this up is because now that I have researched this hotel and understand the sightings and the ghost-like figures that have been seen, I'm now convinced this is the most haunted hotel in Texas.
Does this hotel cost as much as the one we're going to stay in Friona for $59.99?
It's more.
It's more.
Okay. It's more. Because you get spirits, you know, you're paying for ghosts.
Like spirits, they have like vodka and gin?
They have
like
a, no, no, no.
Oh.
They have a boo room. No, they probably have some of those in the room too. Yeah. But they have like a boo room, like bring your boo, but you might get booed like on their website. I'm not even kidding.
Do you
I
remember
looked at
how
it
I just
night.
Turned your microphone back
you did.
To
I
your
don't
mouth
like that.
And then
I don't
you're
like
messing
it.
With
I don't
it?
Like
yeah,
it. Yeah, I know. I don't like it. All right, so let's talk about the Manger Hotel. We are talking about a 20-year-old German immigrant, William Manger, that came to Texas. Chris, we're talking 1840s. This is a lot of history that I'm about to
About to lay on us.
I'm about to lay on you a lot of history. All right. So this is very much what was happening in the 1800s, cattle, right? People traveled by horse and cart. No
Teslas in 1840.
No Teslas.
Nowhere to charge. Not a lot of charge stations around there for your Tesla.
So he wasted no time settling in the open land of San Antonio, Texas. Now, he started actually the first brewery. I'm about to lay some history on you guys. It's called the Western Brewery, and he had a partner, Charles Philipp Degen, who was also another German brewmaster. These guys were good at making beer, is actually what they were really good at.
Yeah, it's kind of like Schneiderbach, the Spetzel Brewery.
That's right.
Yeah.
Lots of Germans Western
in that,
Brewery,
especially in that part of Texas, that's right. Fredericksburg. And
yeah. There's if even you guys have never been to Shiner and gone to visit, you need to. I happen to have family there, so I've been a few times, but it's a pretty cool, Shiner's pretty cool.
Sounds like an order.
It's pretty cool. There's so many places to see. You know, that is the cool thing I had to say about our show is we get to travel and see all these really cool places in Texas that we've never actually been or even heard of.
We've gotten free bottles of wine, but no free travel up to this point. That's our next goal. Free travel. We get plenty of bottles of free wine.
All right. So Western Brewery was the very first brewery of Texas. Hope y'all are taking notes. All right, so Western Brewery is basically built where the Battle of the Alamo took place, right? So we have the Battle of the Alamo. Now, on the other side of the Alamo at the time, there was a boarding house. So the person who ran this boarding house, her name was Mary Gunther.
Did she live in the basement of the Alamo?
No, she did not. She lived in the boarding house. Why?
Because there is no basement.
That's so random.
I've seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Oh, there's no.
Remember the basement? The house where his bike resided. The basement.
No, I don't remember that part.
Okay, sorry. Sorry for my '80s reference.
All right. So Mary was actually one of the first people that Mr. Manger met when he came to San Antonio. He lived there at her boarding house for 3 years, and he finally convinces Mary to marry him. And they wed, and then they decide to put their businesses together, and they build like this brewmaster brewery thing with a hotel. So they turned her her boarding house into a hotel. Now, at the time that they built the Manger Hotel, it was considered the finest hotel west of the Mississippi. It still kind of is because it is still standing. You can go on the Manger Hotel website and book a room. But this was kind of a big deal back in the 1800s, right? They have this big fancy hotel going up.
It was like the Driscoll of the 1840s.
The Driscoll of the 1840s, yeah. That's right. But unfortunately, the Civil War killed the business. They ended up closing because nobody's traveling. There's a war going on. So they decided because they... By the way, these were great people. Even now, you go to the Manger Hotel, because we haven't been there. We are now going. I've already looked at dates that I've picked out. But they have things all over their walls contributing to these owners of this hotel and how it began. But the Civil War killed their business. So William Manger decided he was going to be a good citizen, and he was going to open his doors to the Civil War soldiers who were being injured and house them. If they needed shelter, if they needed food, if they needed a bed to sleep in, really anything. So they closed their door to the public and opened it up to Civil War soldiers.
It's kind of like during COVID where I stayed in that hotel that you wouldn't let me back in the house.
I did
when
it.
I came home from
Y'all,
the hospital.
That's a true story. I kicked him out for 2 straight months because until I figured out what COVID was, and then I let him back.
That's a spooky story right there. That's fit for any Halloween and living in a hotel and having bags of clothes left on your tree out front. You're not even allowed to kiss the dog.
No kissing allowed. All right. So
you got the COVIDs.
While William Manger is opening his doors to all the Civil War soldiers, he dies. He dies in 1871. His death is still a mystery. He wasn't sick. There was really nothing that they can conclude. They never did an autopsy on this guy. So it's a mystery how William Manger died. But he dies in 1871. So it's up to Mary. It's up to Sweet Mary to keep the business going, and that's exactly what she does for a little while. But then she decides to sell it back to the original developer And the man who designed the hotel, and his name is Major J.H. Campman. And in 1887, he decides to add a bar. So we're going to, the Manger Bar, which is just as probably popular as the actual hotel itself because of its patrons that I will mention. So he builds this bar. Now, Chris, we have been to London. You've been once. I've been three times. It's amazing. If you've never been to London, you should go. If you can go around.
Amazing's kind of a.
If you can go at Christmas time, go at Christmas
it's
time.
It's fun, it's but the best. Amazing, not amazing.
I thought it was amazing. But this place is an exact replica of the London's House of Pubs. So this has been, it's full of history in London, which I've never been to the House of Pubs.
So this is a German guy opening a British pub in a Texas town.
It is. And they actually made another replica and opened it in the Netherlands. So there's actually another House of Pubs in the Netherlands. But they built this to make it an exact replica of the House of Pubs in London. Oh, pretty cool stuff.
Pretty cool stuff.
And it's still the same. Like it's still, although it did burn. We'll talk about that. Okay, so just a few years after this beautiful bar is built, they've now, Mary has gotten this hotel off of her hands. She has sold it back to the developer. It burns. So two floors of this hotel burn. It burns pretty bad. It was closed for a little while, but they end up, Chris coming in and revamping it and doing some new stuff. But you know what the problem, like why it all caught on fire was the wood. So they built a lot of their hallways and their walls and their floors. Everything was wood. And basically they said that was their downfall.
What the hell else did you have in 1840?
That's what happens. I don't know. It was all the wood. They said the whole place was just wood, and it all went up in flames.
So basically,
and that's
they huffed
what happened.
And puffed and blew it all down because it was made of wood.
Guys, there was 100 people staying there the night of the fire, and there was a man working and living in the quarters, and it was said that he got up and knocked on every single door and ended up getting everyone out of this place. So nobody died in this fire, thankfully.
Well, you left out the whole portion about how they recruited the Rough Riders here.
I'm not there yet. Oh. I'm so not there yet. You're jumping way ahead of me.
I'm not jumping way ahead.
All right. Well, that's the next one. That's the next one. 1898, a colonel comes into the Manger Bar. Now, it's all rebuilt. It's all looking pretty. Teddy Roosevelt. It's said you can see his spirit in the Manger Bar.
He's a fascinating man.
Man, he
really is.
He really is. If y'all don't know Teddy Roosevelt and researched him, and he is a pretty interesting dude.
Very,
and not only that, he was an amazing recruiter, okay? He could talk anyone into anything.
He's one of my favorite presidents ever.
Over 1,200 men were recruited for the Rough Riders. In this bar, he would sit at a table, he would have cocktails, he would watch people walk in, and he recruited these people into the Rough Riders. Did y'all know the Rough Riders is the most popular volunteer regiment in the history of the world? This is like amazing. So I know that some of y'all are probably like, I don't know what that means. This is pretty amazing stuff. Like he was able to really... He found ranchers. He found cowboys. He found soldiers. He talked to fathers. He talked to grandfathers. Anybody that came into that bar, he would sit down, he would buy them a drink, and he would convince them to join the Rough Riders. Interesting.
It's very appealing.
Yeah.
Just the name alone.
There is one bullet hole that sits above where he actually sat. So he has like this little booth table thing, and there is a bullet hole directly behind of where his head would have been. So it's said that someone was in a bar fight and they pulled out a gun, and that's how the bullet hole got there. Another one would say that they shot it there trying to pretend he was sitting there as though an assassination of a warning sign to him not to sit there. So
sounds like there were a lot of drinks going in this recruitment process. So I can imagine there'd be a bullet hole or two.
Yes. All right, but the Manger Bar, which still is there today, you can go, but that is where, and they have like where he sat. I mean, it's really this kind of beautiful looking place when you look at pictures. But that's where he sat and recruited everyone for the Rough Riders.
So is it going to be the Texas Wine and True Crime Spooky Tour that we're going to rent the big tour bus?
We got Driscoll Hotel. We got the Driscoll in Austin. We're going here in San Antonio.
The Banger Hotel.
By the way, we post all of this on our social media stuff. We do a lot. We try to do like fun stuff with our listeners that are all over Texas. So follow us on there so you can keep up with little field trip stuff that we have planned. Okay, so now let's kind of start talking about the ghosts of the Manger Hotel. I mentioned earlier that I'm pretty convinced this is the most haunted hotel in Texas based on my research. In fact, I've never had like goosebumps on my arms reading about haunted stuff really in Texas until I started reading about this, and I'm like, this is kind of crazy. All right, so remember, we said this was a Civil War base for injured soldiers. So you had people dying left and right in this hotel. That's the first thing, right? And then you have Teddy Roosevelt, right, who spent a lot of time there. In fact, him and another colonel that loved going there so much, they had rooms named after them. There are particular rooms at this hotel that you can request, and I'm going to tell a story about an alligator that is that resided at the hotel for a long time. Somebody left behind an alligator in a hotel. Like, that's how crazy this world used to be. All right.
What do you feed an alligator?
Pet? Yeah, I don't know.
Don't they need some water?
Yeah, but I'll tell you where they kept them.
Okay.
All right. So there were lots of suicides. There were suicides. There were murders, and there were wounded soldiers that died in this hotel. Okay. There was a guy who was a part of the fair. Okay, so there was a traveling fair, right? And he couldn't pay his hotel tab. And they had let him bring in a 750-pound alligator in his room. He didn't even want to take that. He skipped. Obviously, he didn't want to be obvious leaving his hotel room with no money, right? He just needed to go by himself. So he leaves the 750-pound alligator behind in his room at the Manger Hotel, and they end up building this alligator in atrium, solarium, in the smack dab in the middle hotel, and treated it as like the hotel pet. And then they eventually get two other alligators to join this other alligator as like its friends. I mean, what hotel does that? Like, who does that?
He probably couldn't pay his room because he was buying turkey legs at the fair.
For the alligator?
For 40 tickets.
For 40 tickets.
Yeah. That'll break your bank.
All right. So let's talk about one of the ghosts that, by the way, there are said to be over 50 ghosts in this hotel. 50. Which is probably some of the spirits of the Civil War soldiers. There have been many of what do you call them? Ghosts, tracker people,
ghost hunters.
Yeah, yes. They've gone to this hotel. They've done filmings. They've done documentaries and stuff. But they're not sure why this hotel is so haunted. In fact, it was said that no matter what floor you stay on, you're bound to either hear something, see something. So it does kind of give me a little bit of goosebumps to think, like, they basically tell you to prepare yourself to go to this
hotel.
Why are
there no modern day hauntings? It seems like hauntings have gone by the wayside. The ghosts have not come out in all these new hotels and stuff.
Oh, like the new ones being built?
It's because people are not as gullible in the modern day that they're not believing the ghosts or what?
No, I don't. Well, supposedly when the spirit doesn't know where to go, right? They're stuck in work.
I know. I just think we hear more about old haunted hotels versus newer hotels that people have probably died in, but we don't hear about their ghosts.
Oh, well, not yet. At least
let's talk about
maybe in 100 years. Let's talk about Sally White. She was the ghost who was the chambermaid in this hotel. Now, she had a husband who was very abusive. His name was Harry Wheeler. He would get very jealous because she worked at the hotel. I'm sure, you know, you had men hitting on her a little bit, but that was her job. On March 28th, 1876, he got very jealous, and they were living two blocks from the hotel, and she took off running. She takes off running out of her home. She knows he's going to kill her. He's waving a gun in the air. She actually ends up making it to the hotel and ends up on the second or third floor by running up a set of stairs. No one seemed to stop this guy, which I found was very weird. And the person that was that was actually writing about this found it very odd that nobody tried to stop him. But he ends up actually shooting her, and she dies. Now, chambermaids, what they did was they folded your sheets, they made your bed. I'm like, basically what room service, or not room service, but what the maid or whoever comes in and cleans the room. So basically, people have said they see her at the end of their bed folding their sheets or making their bed, or they'll be in the bathroom and they'll look over and they see a spirit of a woman, you know, tucking in their sheets and their bedding. Like, that's kind of freaky.
Is the chambermaid different than a regular maid?
I think that's just what they were called back then, maybe. I don't know where the word chambermaid came from. That's a good Google. That's a good Google question.
I guess your dwelling is the chamber, possibly?
Yeah, yeah.
What was he jealous about?
Well, you know, that's interesting because there was a set of hotel rooms that I looked at, not at the Manger, but and they were called the Chambers. So that must be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Our hotel last weekend was called our chamber.
Our chamber. Yeah.
I think he was jealous because at home she didn't fold the toilet paper into a point like they do at most hotels.
She put all of her effort into the work.
Riled up, you know.
But yeah, so it's said that you can see her spirit, you know, floating around, folding your towels, getting your sheets and your bed straight, because that was a part of her job at the Manger Hotel. All right. And then let's talk about, there was another ghost. Let's talk about the Teddy Roosevelt ghost. So there is a new employee at the Manger Hotel. So this is documented. This person actually ended up writing a book about their experience with Teddy Roosevelt in the Manger Bar. So this is a new employee. He says he was hired to work in the back, basically like a bar back, get the ice and things for the bar. Well, there's these doors, right? So a door that closes off in the back of the bar. And then they said there's another door that is used for patrons to come in and out. Remember, this is built in like the 1800s, right? So there's probably multiple different doors and different hallways and things like that. So he says he's by himself behind the bar, fiddling around with something. And he says he looks up and he sees Teddy Roosevelt. Now, if you look at pictures of Teddy Roosevelt, he always had a stare, like this glare in his eyes, I feel like, when I look at pictures of Teddy Roosevelt. Well, this is exactly how he's staring at this person. So he says that Teddy Roosevelt is just staring at him. He turns around to run out of the door, and the door is locked. Door is, for some reason, locked. And he says his nails are running down the door. He's banging on it. He's screaming. He turns around, and Teddy Roosevelt is still just staring at him. I mean, can you imagine? Like, this person was scared out of his wits. And he wants to get out. So finally, somebody hears him screaming. And they come and open the door, which she says was not locked. She just opens the door. And the guy's like, Teddy Roosevelt is... So he ends up leaving the hotel. He ends up writing about this story. But he swears that the ghost of Teddy Roosevelt just stared at him.
I think this guy was hanging out in the House of Lords bar.
What?
The London boards or whatever, yes.
Too many drinks. I want to say something else about Sally White. If you go, basically the hotel paid for her coffin, her burial. Chris, they paid $7 for her coffin. I mean, imagine like the price today. I mean, I always like looking at like prices. Like so many years ago, just to see the cost of
what it's going to cost to rising bury me. That's what you're looking at.
How much it's going to cost to bury you?
How much of a burden I'm going to put on the bank account to get rid of me?
But there is a receipt, a framed
Neptune
receipt.
Society. That's what I want. That's what I told you.
There, babe. There's a
frame. 700.
There's a framed receipt of them purchasing. And it says, hold on. It's an 1876 receipt. And they paid cash for, and it says, Curdle Chambered, deceased, murdered by her husband. So it says for the grave, they paid $25. For the coffin, they paid $7. So the receipt of this is actually framed and sitting in the hotel.
It's a pine coffin.
That is pretty crazy.
That's kind of, that's
well, it's verification that this stuff actually happened, which I appreciate. Yeah.
Very true.
But yeah, so this was actually, so Mae West... A lot of celebrities and stars stayed at the Mangrove Hotel. I mean, it was a like I said, it was the finest hotel west of the Mississippi, so people would frequent that. It is the Mangrove Bar is the oldest bar in the state of Texas, so you can say you went to the oldest bar in the state of Texas. But yeah, it is still there today. Much more expensive than it was probably back in the 1800s, but. Their history of the Mangrove Hotel lives on, but they said that there have been, and the
how
reason
does
that,
they
how
do they say it's the oldest bar in Texas though?
Well, they probably, well, for one, it's 2022 and it's still going strong. So you have to
oldest
think,
running bar.
I would say oldest run. Yes, yeah. Old, yeah. Oldest running bar.
Like
yeah.
First bar.
No.
Yeah.
No. Gotcha. Oldest running bar. Probably one of the first ones built. I mean, I don't know. I don't know, 1800s, I'm not sure, 1700s.
There was a bar or two built before that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
we're fascinated with history, by the way,
get
if you
a sarsaparilla or something like that.
Sarsaparilla. But there have been said to be over 50 ghosts in this hotel, at least apparitions of, there's a king suite, K-I-N-G, like not just because of a king bed, like the person, he was an actual king who came and stay there, and he died in his suite. And it is said that you can go and book this exact suite, but beware that you might see him laying in the bed with you, which I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I can do that. He's been seen. One lady said she rolled over and he was laying right next to her. Another one said that she saw him standing in the bathroom washing his hands. Another woman said that she had opened her shower curtain and put the towel on and came out of the bathroom and he was sitting on the edge of the bed. I'm like, I don't know. Like,
yeah, we need to do that to confirm or deny.
Because there are people who come and they want to see this stuff, right? There are and so you have people who run out and are freaked out, and then you have people who just like embrace the history and embrace the ghost and say, this is their home. Like, here's where they died. This is where they are. Like, we have to have some sort of level of respect for that. So it's just this weird, I don't know. It's the human body. Like, how do you react if you see that? Do you just go, okay, I'm just going to let it happen, and then they'll eventually go away? Or am I just going to run out of here screaming and never come back? I don't know. We'll find out on our field trip what everybody does.
Because I'm kind of curious myself. I've never encountered a ghost and would love to.
All right. Well, that
I have
is
a lot
a story.
Of questions.
That's yeah, right. There are so there's like 10 more ghosts I could have talked about, but we're gonna now travel to Sun Valley, California. We're gonna travel Valley. Out of Texas. Yeah, we're gonna head to Sun Valley, California.
So this is just wine and true crime from this point moving forward. The Texas involved.
We are allowed to do that occasionally. We do that
occasionally
because there's crimes all over that we have to talk about.
Lord knows, yes.
And I wanted to find something else that happened on Halloween. Anybody heard of the case of Peter and Betty Fabiano? 1957 Halloween. This is old Hollywood that we're going to be talking about here. Old Hollywood, Sun Valley, California, not far from LA. Halloween night, 1957. So this is the case of Betty and Peter Fabiano. Trick-or-treaters were pretty much going inside at this point, Chris. We're getting close to 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. The Fabianos had been busy with trick-or-treaters, so they did, just based on what we now know, based on the crime, there were people ringing the doorbell, knocking. They were awake. They ended up going to bed about a quarter to 11, and around 11, their doorbell rings. Peter Fabiano comes downstairs out of his bedroom, and based on what his wife, because he's no longer here to tell his story, but what his wife had said was, once the doorbell rang, it rang again. This got him frustrated, so when he went downstairs and opened the door, his exact words were, "It's a little late for this, isn't it?" His wife will say those were his words. And the person responds, "No," as they raise a paper bag, concealing a gun, and shoot Peter Fabiano in the chest one time. So he answers the door, he asks a question, this person shoots him, and then runs off. Betty Fabiano hears the shot, and she comes downstairs, sees that the person is no longer there, or whoever committed this crime. So she tells police that she's 39 years old and she has two teenage children from a previous marriage. Peter was their stepfather. But she did not see the person's face. She didn't see the person. She didn't know who it was. So Peter Fabiano is 35 years old. He owns a very, I would say high end at this time, a high end hair salon in Los Angeles, employed mostly women. I would say back then he served in World War II. And by all accounts, this guy had a great business, had friends, had a great marriage, was great to her kids, no problems. So police are trying to figure out who would want to kill this guy. Who shows up at 11 o'clock at night and shoots this man in one time and then just runs off? So his wife immediately gives a name, and I mentioned this earlier. Her name is Joan Rabel. So we're going to talk a little bit about Joan. So his wife gives this name within 24 hours of his murder. So who is Joan? So we don't know much about Joan, Chris. I did some research on this woman, and based on my research, which I thought was a mystery because I couldn't find really anything, in the articles about her, they say she kind of is a mystery. There wasn't much documentation, I guess, in her past. They said that maybe she was an immigrant here from Lithuania or traveled here somewhere from internationally. There just wasn't a lot on this woman. But they did say that she was possibly born in Philadelphia. So a lot of just contradicting information about where this woman was, where she actually came from. But she was into photography. She did hair. She dabbled in some things. But back in 1957, she had just got divorced and was living in Sun Valley, California, and working at the salon Peter Fabiano owned. Okay? So that's okay. How Joan enters this. So she becomes very close friends with them, with the Fabianos. She becomes close friends with Betty. In fact, her and Betty become such good friends. When Betty decides to leave Peter Fabiano for a few months, she moves in with Joan. So she leaves him, moves in with Joan for a little bit, and then they come to terms and say, you know what, we're going to continue our marriage. So she moves out of the house of Jones and then moves back in with her husband. Okay?
Yes.
Following? All right.
I'm following.
So at this time, Joan had one other really good girlfriend besides Betty, and her name is Golden Pizer. By the way, I love that name.
I like that too.
I love that name. Goldyne. Love it. Okay, so Pizer and Joan were very, very close. Pizer would eventually say that Joan, there was, you know, even though the words like, you know, lesbian and infatuation and love, like those words weren't used back then in newspapers when describing relationships like this, but they believe there was some sort of attraction from Golden to Joan. So they became like coffee buddies. So they were gossip friends. Joan would tell Golden all of these stories about Peter and Betty, okay? So she's talking about this couple to this woman who does not know them, all right? Mm-hmm. So really, any information she's feeding her, she's probably going to believe. And that's kind of exactly what happens. So she tells her friend, Golden, that Peter Fabiano is abusive, that he beats Betty, that Betty left him once before because he tried to strangle her and kill her. And it's basically all these terrible things, like he's an evil man. I should have never worked for him, you know, that sort of thing, yeah. Right? Okay. So 4 months of this takes place. She's trying to tell Golden, you know, Betty needs a good life. We need to help Betty. Golden Pizer doesn't know Betty, okay? Remind you, she has no idea what this woman has been through and what she hasn't been through. Yeah. She's just believing everything Joan tells her. So Pizer, who really is in love with Joan, it's never said that, but from what I have researched,
the implication.
I would say the implication is that she was affectionate and wanted Joan's love and acceptance. And basically, she ended up getting Pizer to do her dirty work for her. So what she does is Joan dresses Pizer up in these oversized clothes. She gives her money to go actually and buy a gun. So Joan, she takes Joan's money. She goes and purchases a gun. Joan ends up borrowing a getaway car and drives Pizer to the home of the Fabianos because Again, Pizer doesn't know these people or where they live. So she's dressed in what is described as like men's clothing with red gloves, just oversized clothes. So Joan drives Pizer to the house. Pizer gets out. She rings the doorbell. He answers the door. She shoots him, and she gets back in the car where Joan is waiting. Now, now imagine this. Imagine this. You've put almost like 4 months of your time. By the way, both of these women were divorcees, and that's probably, you know, like maybe the rebound, they said, like that's what investigators eventually said, like maybe Pizer just wanted love and acceptance, and that's why she would have done something like this, because in her background and her life, she wouldn't have been expected to do anything like this. Mm-hmm. But imagine this, she gets back in the car, okay? She gets back in the car with Joan, and Joan leans over, gives her a kiss. Now, this is based on Golden Pizer's testimony. She leans over, gives her a kiss, and tells her, "Forget you ever knew me." She has no intention of ever seeing this woman again in her life.
Because she thinks she's going to get caught?
She used her. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this woman thinks maybe they're going to go have, like, a life together, and this is her best friend, and she's doing her a favor. And this woman says, "Forget you even knew me." And she drops her off, and that's it. But Joan makes one mistake. For a rookie like Golden Pizer, who's never committed a crime probably in her life like this, or even close to it, she realizes Joan never told her what to do with the gun. So she still has the gun on her when Joan...
That is quite the rookie mistake.
That is quite the rookie mistake. So she ends up going to this flagship store and rents a locker and puts the gun in the locker. And because she didn't come back to get the stuff out of her locker in a certain amount of time, it was opened and handed over. The gun was handed over to police. And of course, they could trace of who rented out the locker.
Kind of like Storage Wars in 1957.
So Pizer is questioned because they find the gun in the locker she rented. And she's telling the story. She completely says everything. Joan asked me to do this. Here's where you can find her. So both women are arrested. Okay, they arrest. By the way, if you Google these two women's names, you will see them together in a picture leaving court.
So it was hard to forget that she knew her since they had a picture, right?
Well, that's after they went to the court.
I know.
All right. So, so that was the downfall. She didn't tell her what to do with the gun. So they find the gun. They arrest both of these women. Now, they both have their day in court. Golden Pizer actually was seen. She cried in court. She was remorseful. She said she didn't even know Betty and Peter Fabiano, and the only reason she did this was because she loved Joan and wanted her. She didn't want Betty to suffer, even though she didn't know her, because Joan made it sound like Betty was suffering and needed to get rid of this guy, right? But Joan is in court smiling and flipping her hair and not even really paying attention and acknowledging anything that happened, or really acknowledging Golden. And I'm sure this pissed Golden off, because she probably thought that this was like going to be the love of her life, and she was doing something for her, you know? All right. Well, so again, like I mentioned, when they were writing about this story back in the 1950s, they didn't use the words like lesbian. What they did describe their relationship as, and this is Betty and Joan's relationship, they described it as abnormal. Now, I will say they never found any sort of evidence that Betty and Joan were actually having an affair, but there was speculation that Betty possibly had asked Joan to have her husband murdered. But because Joan never said, "Yes, Betty told me to," and Betty was home, so she didn't do it, right? And she didn't even know Golden Pizer at all. So they basically came to the conclusion that Betty didn't know. You know, but yeah, again, they don't
so
know what
was
said.
She was just being a friend, right?
Yeah, she was being a friend, but Joan wanted more. But we don't actually know if there was ever an actual relationship between these two women when they lived together after she had moved out of her husband's house for those few months. Joan just never said anything. They don't know if it was to protect Betty, you know, from her getting any kind of prison time, or really if the wife had absolutely nothing to do with it, you know, and she just wanted Betty for herself, basically. Yeah. All right, so both women are found guilty. They spent, well, we don't actually know how much time they spent in prison. They were charged with murder, with their sentence 5 to 99 years. They are believed to have spent between 5 and 10 years, excuse me, in prison. Golden Pizer actually passed away in 1998 in Los Angeles. Betty sold the beauty, the hair salon after her husband died, and she ends up remarrying, and she died in 1999 at the age of 81 in Palm Desert, California. And nobody knows what happened to Joan, Chris. Some people think she left town. Some people think she still resided in the Los Angeles area. She never tried to contact Betty after the crime. I mean, just this is so weird. Like, it's just so, you know, I don't know whether Betty had anything to do with it.
Kind of a light sentence too.
Okay, so I thought the same thing, but then I think we're in the 1950s. There is a stereotype. This is women, right? These are women. Surely the husband did something, right? Like, surely these women aren't just gonna. By the way, Golden Pizer pleaded insanity. She was trying. They were trying to get her off. Her lawyer team. Mm-hmm. They were trying to get her off. So she came in with the insanity plea, and they were like, "No, you're not. You clearly knew what you were doing. You weren't insane when you did it. You might have been like infatuated and obsessed with Joan, but you weren't insane when you committed the crime." But yeah, nobody ever knows what happened to Joan, and Betty never spoke to her again. Then everyone went on with their lives after prison, and. Yeah, this is weird.
It's a little weird.
I know. Well, and you know, I think it's like, it, you know, we talk about the stalking cases, or, I mean, imagine like being married to someone and then you have two people plotting to murder one of you. And like, and you don't even really talk to either of them. Like, one, you don't even know. The other one was a friend of yours, but you, from what I gathered, when she moved out of the house back of Joan and moved back in with her husband, there wasn't much communication because she had already left the hair salon. Joan wasn't working there anymore. So there's really no reason for Betty Fabiano to be in contact with her. But that's what I mean. Like, you just never know what people are thinking and doing and saying about you. So they're basically plotting the death of her husband. To give Betty a new life is what Joan had told Golden, to give Betty happiness and to get her out of the abusive relationship she was in.
So is this going to be the hot Halloween costume this year, the Golden Pizer?
Sounds pretty easy. Just put on some, I don't know.
A grotesque painted face with a domino mask.
Yes, she was wearing.
And red gloves like every man wears.
They
right?
said it was so grotesque, the face. So it was described, she had painted the face, right? Painted her face and then had a mask, like a grotesque looking mask on it. I mean, how freaky is that? Like, you open your door and like that's what you see, and then a gun is raised. I mean, it's just so crazy.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised more things don't happen on Halloween night, because if you think about it, not everybody, but lots of disguises.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, a lot of stuff happens on Halloween night.
Hard to really determine who's doing what. I mean, I know stuff happens, but you're just surprised more things do not occur because you're kind of, you're obscured, you know, based on the people wearing costumes, and it seems like you get away with a hell of a lot more.
Well, I also looked into the actual, so this is 1957, right? And then how many times have we heard of now people opening their doors and being shot on Halloween, right? Wearing a mask, the clown with the balloons, the deliveries, like there's cases. So this kind of started, I feel like this was like one of the first that I had heard about the knocking on the doorbell ring. I believe there are two or three cases, even local to us, that have unsolved murders of people like knocking on the door and then shooting them and then running off. It's crazy stuff. All right. But that's the story of Peter and Betty Fabiano. All right. We are, oh my gosh, it's already 1:03. Oh my goodness. All right. Let's see. It's getting later. Does anybody have any questions? Any cases locally that you can think of? Anything? Just anything that comes to mind? Because I'm going to talk about the first basically the first documented homicide in the Texas South Plains. Anybody? Okay. All right. So I like doing this case. I did this when I went to Lubbock because that's in the High Plains. But I like this story because my father grew up in Plainview, Texas, which is in West Texas. And I went there a few times when I was a kid. And when we went to Lubbock, I always appreciate it. We have some friends in Floydada. By the way, did you know Floydada, Texas is the pumpkin capital of the world? There are more pumpkins harvested in Floydada, Texas than anywhere in the world. I would have never known that. She brought me a t-shirt that said it.
You can win a bar bet based on that information, guys.
Yeah, we're giving you some information.
Do you know where the pumpkin capital of the world is?
We need to go there next Halloween. She says they do.
Because there's that one time a year that pumpkins are very important. Yeah. The other 11 months, they're not growing nothing in Floyd anymore, right?
All right. Well, we're going back again to the 1800s. James William Jarrett. So we're going to talk about his murder. So he's a lawyer. And he, when he gets married, Chris, he ends up living in Waxahachie. This isn't very far from us.
Like, yeah, he kind of is, but.
Not far. So he ends up in Waxahachie, but he ends up in the High Plains because he is friends with the land commissioner. So this guy's a lawyer. His friend's a land commissioner and knows about all the land. Well, at this time, the Texas House of Representatives basically said that every piece of land in Texas had to be surveyed and then could be sold, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know much about the whole survey process, but we're talking about the 1800s. So I kind of think of this as what do they charge people when they tell them about a stock that's about to go under, right? And they sell it before.
Insider trading.
Okay, so I kind of feel like this was like insider trading of land, basically in the state of Texas before really kind of any real laws were in place. I mean, this is when, you know, they're traveling by horse and cart. There's cattlemen raising cattle all over Texas. Like, that's what the Texas High Plains was in the 1800s. So this is 1895 in the early 1900s, what we're talking about here. So his friend is the land commissioner, and he tells his buddy, the lawyer, that he has found some land in West Texas that has not been inhabited and is up for grabs. So this lawyer who has money decides to pay for the survey to get ahead of the game, okay? So it kind of already gave him the land. He was paying to have it surveyed. So he ends up buying this land. And he comes and basically back.
2,560 acres?
That's right. But not all of his. Not all of his. He comes back to Waxahachie and tells all of his friends, Follow me. We're going to go to West Texas. We're going to establish our land out there and make it ours. And by the way, this is part of the Llano Estacado, which is another wine. Llano, big winery that was really has been there a very, very long time. But this is the area we're talking about here. So that's what they do. They get in their horse and cart, and they travel all the way to West Texas from Waxahachie. And, well, Chris, the cattlemen out there, they're not happy with this. They don't want a bunch of people coming in on their land. They're saying
city slickers.
Yeah, they're saying he illegally purchased the land, that he, you know, it was a big deal. Like, he had gone to court 21 different times and won every single lawsuit against him.
I was going to say, how did he illegally purchase it?
Because the way he had it surveyed. So they said basically he got the information, insider trading, from someone who sat on the Texas House of Representatives. And because of that, he should have not been able to be basically jump on the gun and purchase the land.
Oh, before it was open to the public.
That's right. That's hey, right. Okay. That's right. Yep. All right. So, but they lose. These cattlemen lose. They keep losing. And they start moving in. So these settlers start coming, inhabiting this area. So there's a place called the Lake Tomb Cattle Company. I do believe it is, I don't know if it's still called that, Chris, but there is a, like the Texas King Ranch thing, like there's still history and family involved. Mm-hmm. There are, by the way, a lot of these people I'm talking about that settled, they have extended family and who still live there. So this, it's called the Strip. And like you said, it's what, over 2,000 acres of land.
Well, they were saying, I mean, based on the act, they were allowing plots as large as 2,560 yeah. acres to be purchased. But I mean, that's,
yeah,
that's a lot of land.
Yeah, and I think, well, and I don't think everyone had money. I think Jarrett had money, and so he was able to actually purchase all of this land. But the cattlemen were not happy. So on Jarrett's
wife
got
really sick. Were the cattlemen
wanting
this land for themselves or something?
Mm-hmm.
I understand.
Well, they didn't want a bunch of people coming in and, yeah. I mean, that's what the land was for, to raise their cattle. I mean, that's what they were using it for,
well,
right?
I mean, but they had no choice if the Texas government is deciding to sell this land. It doesn't sound like the cattle ranchers have much control over that.
Right. And but what they were saying was that it was illegal.
They wanted other
done, right?
other ranchers possibly to buy.
Yeah. Yeah. They just wanted to leave the land open and use it for what they had always been using it for, but now they're like moving them out, right? And this isn't just like an average cattle. This is like cattle companies that had been established and started, you know, and they were doing business on this land is basically. So now they're interrupting their business is the way you should look at it, right? So the cattle companies are out there and now these people are wanting to settle. So it's pushing their business out of West Texas. Well, they were not happy about this. Now he had to travel and he left his wife behind and he ends up being killed, Chris. His body ends up being found. And this is the oldest or the first murder on record in West Texas. And he left behind three children. His wife was 36 years old. Her name was Molly. And she ends up remarrying and herds cattle and builds, you know, and creates this homestead for herself and all of these people. But it was said that, and by the way, she's actually known as Lubbock's first businesswoman.
So the first recorded murder mm-hmm. in West Texas, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. out of all the cowboys drinking in the local bars, mm-hmm. and this is the first one to be recorded?
That's what it said.
Very mm-hmm. interesting.
Mm-hmm. The first, like, documented, yeah. The first, like documented yeah. murder, right, yeah.
Hmm.
Well, he was kind of a big deal. I mean, he was a lawyer. He had sat on, he was like the DA, right? And so he's kind of a big deal. And then he had a lot of money. Him and his wife were very successful. So it was never known who actually killed him. But they do say that it was a guy by the name of Deacon Jim Miller. And he was actually responsible, they think, for like 50 murders. So this guy is hired, but they believe, by the cattle company that owned the land. And
like a regulator.
Like a regulator. And they hired him to kill him.
What movie
and
is that from?
In exchange for the murder, it was promised that he would have things named after him. Okay? So the guy who was killed has nothing named after him. Nothing, even though he established.
So, like Jim Miller Road here, local in Dallas, is named after the murderer, Deacon Jim.
So it was Pap Brownfield, who was a powerful rancher that was allied with the Lake Tomb Cattle Company. It was promised that him and his associate for committing this murder would have things named after him. And Chris, they do. It became the city of Brownfield, and that is named in Pap's honor.
There's a Jim Miller Road.
So these men were promised. So this is now it's never been proven, but what they say is that these men were promised by the cattle companies because they were now back in power that they would now name things after them for committing and killing this guy so they could keep going with their business.
So it sounds like we got to do big things. We want to get a road named after Texas exactly. Wine and True Crime,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, but Jarrett, the guy who was killed, unfortunately, there's nothing named after him, and he was kind of a big deal. But the things that were named were the actual murderers of this guy. Texas is weird. Just history is so weird, right? So strange.
No, it was just it was a it was it's very much a outlaw land for many years, you know.
There's just so much history in Texas. I just love talking about stuff like this. All right, well, we could sit here and talk about 20 other stories that I have, but I know you have other things to do today. It's 1:15. If you would like to ask questions, come get more stickers, or need a keychain for a friend, please come up. Just say hi, introduce yourself.
A keychain that doubles as a wine glass charm. I like that.
I know. One of the girls said, oh, these are the wine glass. I'm like, yeah, you can see they're clearly too big for a wine glass. We do have wine glasses. We had a park way over there because of all the construction. So we just didn't want to carry the
big box. Anyone's interested in a wine glass that we have our logo and stuff, we certainly have those available.
We do.
Due to the pumpkin patch
traffic.
Pumpkin patch posse that was out rolling this morning. It kind of kept us from
getting closer. We almost ran over the scarecrow. Did y'all see the 12-foot scarecrow walking down the street up Main Street? That was a sight to see. All right. Well, we are going to close our show just as we close every one of our podcasts. And we're going to raise our glass. All right. Raise your glass. Raise your glass. Until next time, friends. Stay safe. Have fun. And cheers to next time.
Cheers, everybody. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for coming, everyone. Appreciate it.